This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. American popular culture may find its best expression in music. The Wake County Library plans to launch a film series that explores the history of pop music in this country. The films cover a variety of styles, including blues and gospel, Broadway, jazz, bluegrass, country, rock and roll, and mambo. First screening tomorrow night, 7 o'clock. Jonathan Kramer teaches music and arts at an art studies at North Carolina State University. He's going to be speaking after each screening and is with me now. Jonathan Kramer, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much, Frank.
What's behind this series? What's going on with it?
Well, it started with a project that was launched by a consortium of the American Library Association, the Tribeca Film Festival, and the National Endowment for the Humanities. They sent out invitations to apply for grants to put on the series of five screenings of films that were identified by the Tribeca Film Festival as being together a kind of seminar or class on American popular music. Out of all of the applicants, 50 were chosen from libraries around the country, library systems around the country, one of which was Wake County. Proposals were written on how these films would be presented.
And let me interrupt you there. Forgive me, but these are essentially documentary films. These aren't films where there's a lot of cool music in them and we can tell about what's going on. These are actually, you know, documentaries aimed at explaining the music.
That's right. And there's also a lot of cool music going on.
That's the great thing about music documentaries. First segment, you screen Martin Scorsese's film The Blues. Tell us about that, because it's got John Lomax's project in there. And I think maybe you can tell us more about that.
Yeah, it begins with, well, John Lomax was this very interesting figure in American music history. He was sort of one of the first American song catchers, or ethnomusicologists before the term was invented. A song catcher is one who would follow in the footsteps of Béla Bartók from Hungary, who with the newly invented recording machines went into the rural areas where oral tradition musics flourished but were rapidly dying off because of changes in technology and society and whatnot, and preserved this these oral traditions on disc. So John Lomax from Meridian, Mississippi, became interested in this, and he started his journeys around the South, sharecroppers, hearing about a blues man in prison, for instance, bringing his trunk load of equipment into the prison to record. Well, his most famous find was Lead Belly.
And we've got a recording here. This is John Lomax listening to a prison chain gang. And is this the song is Long John, I think. Let's listen.
Well, it's Long John.
Long John.
He's long gone.
Long gone.
He's long gone.
He's long gone.
He's long gone.
Long John.
Well, the John said.
Well, the John said.
In the chapter 4.
That's a John Lomax recording. That an actual prison chain gang?
Oh, yeah. They're chopping down trees. You can hear the beats of the song being performed with axes on the tree trunks. And there's also video that goes with that that they'll see on the documentary.
What's interesting, too, is that when you begin recording these songs and people from other parts of the world hear the folk traditions in places they never get, it also opens up an inquiry, kind of a scholarly inquiry. What's going on behind that? And so it really gets us curious about who those people were, and it opened up a whole different field of scholarship as well as popular culture in those areas, didn't it?
Well, these are the people that are kind of invisible in history, the peasant societies of Europe, for instance, or the sharecroppers of the Deep South who leave no literary record behind them. So now in the 20th century, we have the technologies, photography, video, sound recording, to document the lives of these people. And so their voices, their songs, their stories live and become part of and a richer part of the fabric of American academic life and also American cultural life.
Because this is, in a way, and I think it's probably more the technology than anything that gives birth to popular music. It's popular because we can play it to everybody all at once, right? Is that part of it?
That's right. The technologies of mass media that came about at the beginning of the 20th century were probably the most important event in the history of music since the invention of notation, and probably more so, for the first time in human history, a song can be separated from the singer. And now, through the broadcast mechanisms of phonographs and radio, these songs that had been isolated in rural Mississippi, for instance, hit the airwaves and spread out across the South and influenced all kinds of genres and styles and individual young people who then went on to become the Bob Dylans, Elvis Presleys, and B.B. Kings.
Well, and that kind of takes us to our next figure in this series, Thomas Dorsey. You talk about influences, the influence of gospel and blues living together, one on Saturday night and the other Sunday morning. Tell us about Thomas Dorsey.
Well, so on our first event tomorrow night, we'll be pairing this Martin Scorsese documentary with another documentary about American gospel music called Say Amen, Somebody. And it will feature Thomas A. Dorsey at 94 years old, telling the story of how he wrote Take My Hand, Precious Lord, his great gospel hit.
And he was the one, did he not just sort of marry, or was this not the beginning of trying to marry the secular, the sacred and the profane?
He had been a blues man, a blues piano player called, I think, Georgia Sam or something like that. And when he first started using the energies and rhythms and harmonies of blues in his hymnals, in his Sunday morning services, he was criticized. Why are you bringing the music of the juke joint and honky-tonk into church? But the parishioners loved it and found that they could become ecstatic through this music that had previously been the dance music of Saturday night.
Let's listen to a clip from Say Amen about Thomas Dorsey.
Let's go.
Gracious Lord. I love your name. When I look back from whence I came, sometimes stumbling, sometimes falling.
And that's a pretty traditional gospel song, not one that he had to transform, because he did like to take the lyrics and just sort of, instead of applying it to your lover, he'd apply it to God, and it all sounded right on Sunday morning, huh?
It did. One of the most beautiful things I think I've ever seen is the video that goes with what you just saw. At 94 years old, in church, in his ecclesiastical robes, singing this. This particular song was based on a 19th century traditional hymnal, Protestant hymn. The kinds of call and response that go into it come out of course, the African and the African side of the hyphen, African American tradition.
And these boundaries were permeable. Not only could you transform a honky tonk sound, a song into a hymn, you could go the other way and take a hymn and make it a gospel hit.
That's right. Ray Charles did that and received quite a bit of flack for taking a gospel song and changing "Dear Lord" to "Dear Lover" kind of thing, you know, and working across that divide, you know, that one's passions can be directed in multiple directions.
Love is infinite. You're going to be playing a volume of The History of Rock and Roll, this one produced by Quincy Jones, 1963 to 67. So this could be a golden age of rock and roll, might it?
It was also my golden age.
There we go.
That's one of the wonderful things about this event, that the history of the music that we're talking about, the history of music that was preserved in sound recording, is also the history of many of our individual lives. We lived through those decades of the Vietnam War, the Civil Rights Movement, the 70s. And the music that we were going to be talking about was the soundtrack of our own coming of age. So in this particular one, the portion of the film we're going to show features Bob Dylan, and it's the part of his career where he had become this amazing folk singer who suddenly went electric, and it's that story from the Newport Folk Festival in 1965 when he brought his rock band and his his megawatt speakers and blasted the crowds who would come there to hear Peter, Paul, and Mary blowing in the wind.
Well, but it also points to an interesting schism in the history of popular music in rock and roll, not unlike the gospel split. Can you marry the sacred and the profane in gospel music? And the fight in rock and roll was whether you're going to write another silly love song or whether it was going to be protest music about a deep social issue that really, really mattered.
And that's where Bob Dylan really was the revolutionary. He had started out with a rock band in high school. And the reason why he gravitated toward folk was he had heard the songs of Woody Guthrie written in the Depression era. And he said, these are serious songs about serious matters. And there are serious matters that I see in my own society. This is in the early 60s, you know, before the big these big revolutionary changes happen, or right on the cusp of them. And he started adapting the genres of the 1930s, the talking blues, in order to load up his performances with lots of words, words that to him were important and words that addressed both important personal matters and social issues and weren't just about rock around the clock.
We remember Bob Dylan.
This is Carl. It's all right, Ma. I'm only bleeding. Ho, ho, ho. Darkness at the break of noon. Shadows even the silver spoon. The handmade blade, the child's balloon. Eclipses both the sun and moon. To understand, you know too soon. There's no sense in trying. As pointed threats, they bluff with scorn. Suicide remarks are torn from the fool's gold mouthpiece. The hollow horn plays wasted words, proves to warn that he not busy being born is busy dying.
There you go. And as you point out, when he moved away from that rootsy kind of grassroots sound and acoustic sound, his fans got really mad.
Well, some of his fans got really mad, and of course, an enormous sector of the population dug it, as it were. You know, one of the wonderful things listening to that that little clip is that you'd get this kind of stream of language. Some of it you got, some of it you didn't get. In the LPs, the words were printed on the back, and we in college would pore over them trying to figure out what it meant. And then all of a sudden, there would be this line, they not busy being born or busy dying, that you could have as a bumper sticker that would just, you know, resonate so deeply with the aspirations of his generation.
You're going to move on, and Janis Joplin is also a part of this part of the story.
Well, again, you can see the deep influence of the blues, of the Delta blues, as it spread through all of the genres, country western, gospel, blues, and rock. And Janis Joplin was so exceptional because she was able to produce a voice that seemed to capture the blues that weren't strictly identified with only the African-American experience in the African-American community, but with all of America. It's certainly young America, the angst, the anguish of just growing up and being an adolescent, the anguish of a society divided not by red state and blue state, but by fathers and sons at that time, the generation gap, as it was called.
Her success certainly suggests that she was able to bridge that and reach that other audience, and yet there was this controversy around her and others about this question of appropriation. Whose tradition is this? And that was sort of part of the argument that surrounded her and others who brought blues into the rock and roll quarters.
That's right. But when I was 17, when Janis enters popular culture and I'm, you know, sort of on the threshold of adulthood, those niceties were lost on us. We just like to sit there with our ear right up against the speakers and take it all in.
Let's listen to Janis Joplin.
Honey grabbed a hold of and it fell like a ball and chain.
Well, Janis Joplin. We're going to hear more from her at the film series. We're running out of time, but I know you've got a story. You met Janis Joplin.
I did. Oh, so here we go. I'll try to keep it short. So I was at Wesleyan University, and my friends were very much involved with the emerging rock and roll culture. But I was a classical cellist, and all of the big names of the time, the Rolling Stones, the Grateful Dead, were kind of lost on me. I'd heard vaguely about them, but I didn't know really who they were, and I didn't listen to their music very much at that point. That would come later. So Big Brother and the Holding Company was the name of Janis's band before Janis Joplin was famous as a solo artist. And Big Brother and the Holding Company was going to play at Wesleyan at a mixer. That's when this all-boys sort of prep school university would welcome the ladies from Connecticut College for Women, and would all get together and have a little bit of estrogen in the mix. So the administration had heard a little bit about Big Brother and the Holding Company, and their famous headshot publicity photo had Janis, their lead singer, holding up her middle finger. And the administration got nervous, and they said, well, in order to keep the lid on things, we'll have all the men be required to wear jackets and ties. Well, it seems like a small thing in 1967, but there were those of us more revolutionary undergraduates who felt that this was an imposition on our freedom of expression. And so we protested, but we lost the protest. So that evening, I'm in the cafeteria, and my friends point over to a table in the corner and say, that's Janis Joplin with her band. Why don't you go over there and tell her to, you know, why didn't she just come out and tell everyone to just go to hell? Actually, she used much stronger words than that. I was told to tamp it down. So I went over to her and I said, you know what? We all have to wear jackets and ties. Why don't you just come out and tell everyone to go to hell and don't play and, you know, join our protest? And she said, honey, looking at me with unbelievable sympathy and pity, this sort of fat, pimply 17-year-old, honey, I wouldn't tell anyone to go to hell, even you.
But you met her.
I've treasured that story all my life.
Jonathan Kramer teaches music and art studies at North Carolina State. America's Music is a 6-week film performance series at North Carolina Regional Branch of Wake County Public Library. Jonathan's going to be talking after each one.
That's right.
That's great. And it starts this first screening tomorrow night, 7 o'clock. Thanks for listening. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.